All right, welcome to class. Before we dive in, are there comments, questions, concerns, other things for me? Yes.
I have a question about the first question of the quiz is about what's good in underwear that you can't change.
Yeah.
On the quiz.
Like a fixed function.
Yeah.
Okay. Fixed.
Yeah.
Okay, what's the question?
I'm just like wondering where like all the choices are done if they're not fixed. Like what part of the that
So where do we specify vertex data?
Vertex.
In our JavaScript or C or whatever else we're writing, right? The artist gives it to us. It is truly arbitrarily any language you want, any source you want, anything can specify the vertex data. Also, the geometry shader can also specify the vertex data. So you can also do it on the graphics card if you would prefer. Model view projection matrices, where does that happen? The vertex shader, dividing by W. Also the vertex shader. We didn't talk about this piece, but nobody thought it was fixed functionality, so hooray. Or one person did, sorry, one person. I shouldn't have said you were nobody. Depth buffer. Fixed functionality. It is partially programmable. You could argue it's arbitrarily programmable, because your fragment shader can pick any number at once, and you can pick any comparison function you want. So you can you could argue it's either way. But it's usually considered to be fixed functionality because you can't write code for it. You can just say, there are 12 comparison functions, and I can specify the number. Screen clipping is totally fixed. You are just not allowed to say, I want my screen to be shaped like a donut and have some pixels that are off the screen. Yes?
If you just answered one of them correctly, you get...
This was a single select.
Oh, it's a single select.
Yep. Yeah. And then computing useful matrices. So this actually was fixed functionality in OpenGL 1. And then became variable function. Anyway, so like GL rotate and GL frustum and so on are built into OpenGL's libraries, but you can do them however you want in your source code, just like the vertex data. And you could theoretically even create them. No, you can't create them in geometry here. It could be uniforms. But yeah, you can do that. Other questions?
So 3, 4, and 5 was the output of control logic and option for all of these. Oh, not for 3. Okay.
Other questions? Incidentally, 7 has a more correct answer. Which one is more correct? Yeah, which the minority of you said. This is also correct, but this is much more correct. And I attempted to only make one of them correct, but I decided to give them both to you anyway. Because one if in your function only cuts the efficiency in half, whereas one while on average cuts the efficiency every single time it runs in half, and so tends to have a much, much bigger result here. A for loop that always does the same things works fine. This didn't actually used to be the case. Early graphics cards, when they saw a branch, would always split in half, even if there were 0 threads in the other one. That has stopped being the case in more modern cards. So, yeah.
I was reading up on it, and like there are now like ways for you to compile like Clang to your like graphics card.
Correct. And it will do different optimizations of like it'll do like 50-fold loop enrolling or whatever it needs to do, and then instead of having an if case for the rest of the loop enrolling, it'll just start doing something that doesn't do anything. And yeah, we're getting pretty good at learning how to write this at the low end, and we haven't, in my opinion, we haven't yet got good at creating a language where people are happy to write this code. We're getting better; it improves every year, but it's still There are multiple papers on this every year that get published about, we came up with a better way of writing highly parallel code. And then we have to publish that paper again next year because we were wrong. Yes?
When you parallelize code, are you removing the branching, or are you just like kind of hiding it in the way you code?
No, you're not branching.
Okay.
For this kind of code, you want to not branch.
Are there a lot of problems where that's just not possible then?
There are some. Surprisingly often, though, you can sort of deal with this by adding odd little loops. So let me just give an example of something you might do. Let's suppose you want to navigate a tree as, I don't know, maybe a spatial bounding hierarchy. Okay? But your tree does not have uniform depth. Okay? And maybe you don't even know how deep your tree is going to be in advance. So you need to have some sort of navigate through here to find out what rays to intersect with, but you want to stop at a fixed time. So what you do is you just take little loop pointers here. Okay? You just, at the leaves, you just say it goes to itself. And then if I step down three levels down, right, maybe I have something down here, right? But I have a loop here, and then I could have a loop pointer here, and a self-pointer there. If I go three levels from the root, I will reach the leaves. Some of them were only one level down, some were two, some were three, doesn't matter, I went three, I got to the leaf of every single branch. So sometimes you change your data structures like this to do things that are wasteful if you could stop every time, but because you can go in sequence, you can do these sorts of things. So there are things you wouldn't necessarily assume could fix that you could just fix and make things work. Yeah?
So this means you need to pre-compute the height of the tree beforehand.
You need the maximum height of the tree.
Yeah, max height, or use a high number.
Correct.
Okay.
Right. And so, you know, I actually don't know what the current state of this has been. A few years since I read a spatial bounding hierarchy and graphics card paper. But say 5 years ago, this was sort of just coming out, this idea. And what they would do is you make a spatial bounding hierarchy, you pick the depth in advance. You'd say, we're having at most a sixth level spatial bounding hierarchy. And if there ends up being 100 objects down here, it's just going to be slow, right? And so you would create that in advance and make the loop pointers and so on. And you could actually, because this design, you can actually theoretically even create the spatial bounding hierarchy on the hardware and have it change these loops to other loops, although that's a somewhat more complicated task. Yeah?
Is it safe to say that GPUs do a lot of speculation in order to achieve parallelism?
No. So typically, they avoid the, I need a whole lot of transistors to make things work. So things like speculation are, you only speculate when you don't know what you're going to do next. If you didn't know what you were going to do next, you're probably going to fork in half, which means you're already in a bad situation. Right? So speculation is a sort of a single thread type of optimization, which is not the main way these go. That doesn't mean they don't have any. But things like branch prediction, speculation, these things where I don't know what I'm going to do next, if you didn't know what you're going to do next, you're already in a bad situation. Other questions? Yeah?
What are warps?
Yeah, all right, so a warp is a name of a group of, it's the thing that's all moving through together. Okay, so when we said we have a whole bunch of copies all running the same thing, what are they that are all running? Well, it's not a thread, because every thread has its own call stack, and this has one shared call stack. It's not a fiber, because those are cooperative. Anyway, the name of that group of things that works through together is a warp.
It's a group of threads?
It's a group of, it's one thread that is running on multiple data.
Okay.
Yeah. It's not a concept we have in desktop computer, like in your CPU yet. Although we may yet get that point. So a graphics card will typically have threads and warps. And so you'll have multiple threads, each running their own control logic, and you'll have multiple warps, many thousands of warps, thousands of individual lines inside of a warp, inside of a thread. Yep. And so there's often this idea that a thread will have a warp that went the true branch and a warp that went the false branch, and the warp will split in half, and you'll run one warp and then the other. And yeah. I'm not a big fan of their use of the word warp. My understanding, I haven't verified this, my understanding is it came from the idea of warp versus woof in weaving, or woof, depending on what part of the country you're in, rather than warp speed, because threads woven warps anyway. And I guess it sort of makes sense, but I don't think many people think about that term. Other questions? Sorry, I'm seeing a lot of blank stares. I have heard of warp and woof before. Oh. Right. This is so not graphics, but all right. Warp and woof. Let's just see what we get. Yeah. Also called the weft instead of the woof. So, when you weave, okay, you have the warp, which are the strands you stretch across the loom initially, and then the woof, or weft, which goes back and forth. And so this group of threads that are forced to do the same thing is the warp. This was their idea, except they're not really threads, they're fiber anyway. The wording doesn't work out, but I believe that was why they decided to try calling it that. All right. Other questions? Okay. I am aware that somebody came up to me after class about 2 weeks ago and said, some class could we talk about how such and such works? And I don't remember who it was or what they asked. Does anybody remember doing this? Yeah.
Was it why certain things look like differently if they're next to something else?
Oh, yeah. Okay, it was like the color visual illusions, right?
I think so.
Yeah, all right. I think, if I remember right, if I believe the visual illusion page on Wikipedia, yeah, this is the standard one. So let's actually look at this image. Okay. I am not logged in. I don't know why it told me that. I knew I wasn't logged in. All right, let's zoom in on this picture here, and let's consider this image. Hey, the question is, which is darker, A or B? And some of you have seen this illusion before and know the answer, but can you convince your eyes it's actually true? They're the same. They're exactly the same tone. Are you capable of convincing your eyes this is true? And that is because your brain doesn't do what computer vision does. Okay? So we may eventually get computer vision that does this, but your brain sees a shadow on checkerboards and sees those as two things. And so when you ask what color are these checkerboards, you're like, oh, that's a dark one, that's a light one, and this is all uniformly colored because the shadow, your brain edits out the shadow. It knows about shadows. And it just removes it from what you're seeing. So you can see the shadow and you can see the checkerboard, but when you ask what the color is, your brain has learned to remove the shadow from the conversation. Okay? And to force it to say, ah, well, this pixel is 50% intensity and so is that one, your brain just doesn't do that. Okay? And so this is a whole space of our brains are too good at their job. This is the basis of most visual illusions and optical illusions, is your brain interprets what it sees as if it was seeing the real world, when it's not, and then we ask you what it was really seeing, and it tells you what the world would be like if it was seeing that. There is actually just recently, there's been a handful of initial papers about what are the optical illusions that different computer vision algorithms have. And they're different, okay? Because they see differently, their algorithms are different, and so the things that will fool them are not the things that will fool us. Some people are very worried about this, because it means that humans can't tell if you put an optical illusion in the street for a car, right? If I went out onto the street and I painted something that was designed to look like a pit, the police would notice, why did you paint a pit in the street, right? But if I paint something that looks like a pit to a car, it just is random pixels, right? It doesn't mean anything, right? So the principle is that the different vision, that's a whole concern for that community that they will continue to make progress on. But our brains will interpret completely flat images that were designed to be problems like this as if. And this will actually happen even if you remove the cylinder. It's easier with the cylinder, because your brain is used to objects casting shadows. But if we remove the cylinder and still had this darker region, your brain would still see the pattern of the checkers and the pattern of this darker region and treat those separately. And there is various research going into figuring out how to represent images that way, to make better compression, to understand how vision and graphics can make things work better for the way we, our eyes actually see. Other questions? All right, so I added after class last time a link to vote on topics based on our list of topics. 15 people have. Partly this was my fault, because I didn't think about the right way of making the quiz in advance, so it's annoying to take. As any of you have taken note, you have to scroll down and click a lot of things. Anyway, let's just briefly look at the current results. So first off, we won't be able to do what people ask for. So we have an average of a day on cloth, just over a day on connections to other fields. Well over a day, like a day and a half, on current real-time rendering, so up to like 4.5 days. This averages out somewhere close to 2 days on 4D hyper objects. Yeah.
So my friend and I both thought this is like, how willing are you to spend time on? So we're like 9 means like...
I'm pretty sure it says, select your ideal number of days to devote to each topic. Okay, can I speak for 5 days, 10 days even, about 40 hyper objects? Yes. If you misunderstood this quiz, I believe I set it up so you can edit your answers. And would appreciate some feedback. I actually don't know what we'll do on Thursday yet. I may have enough feedback here, we'll do something. I may just decide to talk about something else that I think is interesting. But yes, I would encourage, I guess I've already got a couple more responses, huzzah. I would encourage you to look through this and see what you think is interesting. There are 10 more days of class. It doesn't have to add up to 10, I can divide. Right? But that's my estimate. If you could make the schedule, what would it be? And I only have integral days, so if you want half a day on something, sorry. Presumably you'll say 1, somebody else will say 0, and it'll average out. So, that's up. Yes, but not enough data for me to really say what's going on there. And then today we get to talk about animation. Animation is arguably either the most complicated or the simplest part of graphics. Let's start with why we might say it's the simplest part of graphics. And actually, to think about why it's the most part of our graphics, let's just look at the in-betweening article on Wikipedia. And let's look at this animated GIF, or GIF, depending on which way you like to pronounce. All right, this is not a particularly fascinating animated GIF, or GIF. But it is designed to bring across the concept that all an animation is a sequence of frames, which each one of which is a static image. How do you make an animation? You paint a lot of pictures. We know how to paint pictures. Ta-da, we know how to do animation. Okay, you just do it over and over again with slightly different artist-supplied data. Most of the interesting part of animation, there's a little bit of interesting part about the visualization. We'll talk a little about motion blur just briefly. But most of the interesting thing here is actually artist support tools. In that sense, sort of like curve specification. Could the artist have given us every point along the curve? Sure, but we can also help them out. And so a lot of what we think about in animation is not how do we animate, but how do we make life easier for animators. And so that's what we're going to spend most of today talking about. However, before we do that, let's talk just really briefly, and I don't think I made a good list. Let's talk about motion blur. All right. Oh, wow. Yeah. Let's look at this one. Okay. Here is a picture. I don't know if this was made with a camera or if this was made by a computer. Probably by a camera, but it's so blurry it's hard to tell. Okay. This is the idea of motion blur. Motion blur was originally an artifact people tried to remove. And then they realized it might actually be useful, and then people got so used to looking at it, they kept seeing it. And so then we have people that spend significant effort making pictures like this, where they use their ray tracer to make a picture, and then they make sure it's blurry. Right? And why did they do that? Well, because we expect this. Why do we expect this? Motion blur is an artifact caused by exposure time. Okay? So we talked a little about exposure time earlier, right? How do I know how many photons hit the photoreceptor inside of my camera after light passes through the lens? Okay, so light comes into the lens, it hits the camera. I only get a narrow swath of photons that appear, and there's some chance any given photon won't cause my receptor to notice it. And so to get a nice picture, I need to keep the lens open long enough that I get enough photons that I can tell they were there. And the longer we leave the lens open, the smaller the lens can be, which makes a more focused picture, and the better we can get light in a very dim environment, the more photons we can collect. And so long exposures make it easier to get high quality images, just generally. But they also make it much more dependent on whatever this thing was moving. And if it was moving, then those photons won't always arrive seeing the thing that was there, right? If I try to take a picture, I don't know if you've ever tried this, sometime pull out your phone and try to catch a picture of a housefly on the wing. It is hard. Not that you can't get a housefly in frame, but you can't get it to stay still on the wing long enough that it looks like anything other than a vaguely dark streak. Right? Because your cell phone has a relatively long exposure time. And so the longer your exposure time is, the more we get an average of all of the places the object has been in our exposure for an actual camera. So for an actual camera, it's hard to get crisp images of moving objects. For a computer, it's hard to get blurry things of things moving. Because how do we do that? So let's start with the simplest way to simulate motion blur. And that is with anti-aliased ray tracing. So if I do anti-aliased ray tracing, remember how we did that. We said for each individual pixel, we're going to shoot a lot of rays into the scene and average their results. Okay? I can just move all of the objects a fraction of a frame's time between each ray I shoot. And poof, I will get a simulation of actual physical motion blur for whatever my exposure function is. Now, it's worth noting that when we think about exposure of movies, yeah, this is a little side note here. All right, let's think a little bit about old reel-to-reel video film. All right, so we have this idea where we have film going along, and how do we detect what's going on? So we have some sort of aperture with lenses and so on, and it's focusing light, and we run film in front of it and then around back onto the reel. Okay, we keep the film entirely enclosed except for this little period of time. And the way these things worked in the old days when it was all mechanical is these were all physically spinning around and moving the film across the different routes. And then as they spun via some gear sitting in front of the camera, so if you're sort of looking out from the camera's view, there would be a disc with an opening on it that would just spin around and around. And when the opening spun down in front of the film, we would get light. And then as the opening passed away, the light would stop. And so the narrower you can make this opening, the crisper your picture would appear on your film, but the shorter your exposure time. And so it was common to try to make this fairly narrow. So early in the days of successful film-based cameras, these things sort of gravitated towards being somewhere between a quarter and an eighth of the circle. And then we started moving to more advanced technologies, but people were used to a quarter or eighth of the circle motion blur. We actually use the same thing for a projector. So old films would only be flashing light for a quarter or an eighth of the time, and the rest of the time the room would be completely black. and you have a flash, 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 right? And your eye would blur that together. Your eye would see motion. How fast that has to happen actually varies by individual. So some people, the flashy kind of films cause great headaches to, and they've been a lot happier since we've had digital cameras that instead show a picture the whole time. But that's mostly a side note. We became so accustomed to this that it's actually common when you're making digital movies today to do this kind of motion blur. To do motion blur that pretends to be a camera that has a quarter or an eighth of the frame exposure and the rest of the time it's not there. And why? Because that's what people are used to seeing. We aren't used to seeing the real world, we're used to seeing films of the real world. And now we're used to seeing computer-generated simulations of films of the real world. And we just keep giving people what they expect. Yes?
Is that why when you film in like slow-mo, it looks like too fast when you rewatch it, or like in real time, if you know what I mean?
I don't know what you mean.
Okay.
I can't imagine how watching a film in slow motion would appear too fast.
No, like in the... I'll show you.
Okay. Do you mean the motion blur looks too long?
Like when you have it in slow-mo mode, like it's just like going faster and like you move your hand in front of your phone, it looks like too fast.
Sorry. I don't relate to this comment. Yeah?
Essentially you're filming at a higher frame rate so that it could slow it down, but you're viewing it at like a normal speed, I think is what he's trying to say.
Oh.
Essentially you have just more frames per second than you usually would.
Yeah, I assume you have spent so much time looking at screens that you have become very accustomed to what you have. There's interesting things. So because of the desire of slow motion instant replays in sports television started using high frame captures, much higher than they could show on the screen, and then just showing every fourth, every eighth frame in the first broadcast, and then for the instant replay, showing all of them. And this actually causes, still today, most sports broadcasts have dramatically less motion blur. Because they've actually captured a much higher frame rate and then throw most of the frames away to show it to you at real time, right? And there have been studies about could we reinsert the kind of motion blur you're used to, but people actually become accustomed to sports looks crisp. Okay? And there's actually all this, like, does that mean if I want to make a film that looks crisp, should I, like, get rid of motion blur? Because we can basically get rid of motion blur, or almost completely get rid of it. We've got really good technology these days, but we still typically include it. Yes?
I was in Best Buy a few weeks ago, and they were selling a TV that had an extra special processor specifically for taking out all the motion blur in the picture.
Yep.
It's almost like putting in an extra work just to take it out.
Yep. That's right. Yeah, so we've started, it was about 10 years ago that we figured out how to create the correct inverse convolution filter to almost remove motion blur. And so now you can buy systems that will run this algorithm to remove what we added to make you think it was filmed on chemical film when it wasn't. Right? Yeah. So where will all this go? I don't know. There was a long time when we were getting better at making screens, I was hopeful we'd start seeing high frame rates, and instead we made high resolutions. And there's all kinds of things about motion aliasing that could be problems with that, but yeah.
What did The Hobbit get at 60 frames per second?
40
and, oh, and then everyone complains because it made them feel safer or something weird like that.
Maybe, I don't know.
People found it weird.
Yeah. I have always had a somewhat higher than average ability to detect frame rates. So if I concentrate, I can actually see the flickering of fluorescent bulbs, which flicker at 120 frames per second. I have to pause for a while to see it, but I can see it after a while. These ones actually are pretty good. They have a much lower drop in between. But anyway, right, most people don't see at 120 frames per second. Many people, if you try, they can learn to see up to 60 frames per second each individual frame with practice. Right, and you can teach people to see faster. Most of you have been taught to see slow by watching a lot of animated stuff, often at 30 frames a second. Your eye naturally sees significantly faster than that, but most of you have learned over the course of your life staring at screens to not even notice it. Is this good? Is this bad? It makes movies more enjoyable, so huzzah, right? Anyway. Okay. So, the simple way to make Simple way to make motion blur is simulate motion blur. There is actually another fairly straightforward way of faking motion blur that's often used if you aren't trying to ray trace at a really high resolution, sometimes even if you are, which is essentially at every pixel, in addition to having red, green, blue, presumably also depth because we got that by accident as part of our process, we can also have flow. What direction on the screen was this pixel moving and how fast? So we can get sort of a vector field across the whole screen of the motion of that object. If we know how things are moving, it's not hard to get the velocity of that location. If we have this vector field across the whole screen, we can use that to just sort of average pixels with pixels nearby in their direction of motion. And so we can do this post-processing step. This works very well if everything's moving similarly. The place this has trouble is when you have some static space, like you have, I don't know, maybe we have some sort of end of the hallway with some hallway behind it, okay? And then we have something that's trying to go sprinting through here, okay? And so we need the thing to have a lot of motion blur. And this little boundary right here, where one pixel has a strong speed and the next has a no speed, what do you draw? Okay? And there are various heuristics and rules about how to try to figure this out. That's actually part of the reason you want to keep Z. Which one's in front of the other one? Does this matter? Because we also have that same phenomena right here, where the head's moving fast and the wall behind it isn't. And we want this one to blur and that one not to blur, and so we use the Z and so on. So we can come up with more and more sophisticated algorithms for simulating this unfortunate artifact of film because people expect to see it. And so there are various approximations. None of them are particularly complicated. They all involve some amount of just averaging pixels based on something you measured. But exactly how you do that has a lot of nuance, and how much time you want to spend on it varies as well. So this is the basic idea of motion blur. I should not have that label above that picture. Okay. All right. So that's the rendering part. Everything else is the scene generation part. Is how do we create the information about something moving? Let's start with the theoretic version, and then let's jump on to the actual version. Let's imagine that we wanted to have a 1D scene. One dimension. A one-dimensional scene is a fairly straightforward thing because it's only a line. Okay, and because we're rendering it, it's only a line segment. So I might decide that my 1D scene, maybe this is the window of things that could exist, and there's something here, and there's something there, and there's something there. Okay? And so I can just give a handful of numbers and describe the scene. Maybe I decide, you know what, this one is actually red. Okay? But this would be a scene. Now, why would we ever draw a 1D scene? We won't, but it'll make it easier to then talk about the theoretic ideal of what the artist would supply for us to draw. So if we think about this direction as being x, we can draw another direction, time. Okay? And we could ask the user, the artist, to supply the space-time volume of the object. We could say, hey, you want this red object, don't tell me two numbers, tell me its shape. Whatever its shape happens to be. Okay? And then how would we animate? We would just take a slice of T, we'd intersect the object with a plane where time is constant, and draw whatever we see. And there's nothing magic about 1D except it lets me draw it. And it's really hard to draw this in more dimensions. Okay? This is the theoretic concept of what we want to give the computer. It just wants time to be another dimension. Unfortunately, it's really hard to get artists to create this. Right? It's hard enough to train people to create 3D image data, tell them to make 4D data, And then tell them one of the dimensions should have the behavior of time as opposed to space, so objects should stay constant volume in that dimension, but not in other dimensions. It's really hard to do. So we almost never get this pure ideal data. It just doesn't occur. But this is the ideal, and so what we're doing largely when we are helping animators is we're providing tools to make it easier for them to give us information by which we can derive this data, because this is what we need. We have to know at any given point in time where are the objects. We need to be able to slice through this. And so we need the artist to be able to give us something like that. Let's talk first about what the artist wants to give us. Wherever I have this. Okay. Let's start with skeletal animation. This is not necessarily what the artist thinks they want to give us at first, but we train them it is. We train them to think about things being rigid bits with fluffy stuff around it, or squishy stuff around it. We train them to think about bones. Now, we really, really, really do not mean bones. Bones move messily, okay? And we'll give an example of that here. But we're giving something that's sort of like bones. And we're gonna say, tell us how long it is and what it's attached to. And then you're welcome to give us at one point in time where was the bone, at the next point in time where was the bone. And we, the computer scientists, will use the conservation of length and rotation and so on to tell you what all of the in-between states were. This is technically just one version of something called tweening or in-betweening. And before this was computer animation, this was something that happened in cell animation. So back in the days when people were drawing animations by hand, which they still do, of course, what they would do is the good artists, the artists the company trusted, would draw the important frames. Right? If they were drawing somebody running, they would draw the frames where the legs are all the way apart, maybe the ones that are completely overlapped with each other, then all the way apart again, and only those. And then they hand it off to the cheap animators to draw a lot of little copies where things have moved a little bit. And those cheap animators were called tweeners. Okay? Because their job was to do the in-betweens. Not to make any important decisions, just to make a lot of pictures that are somewhere between these two pictures. Okay? And the tweening is still a job. You can still get a tweening as a cell animator. It can still be done. This actually turned out to be good practice for artists because they would learn to completely ape somebody else's style. Right? And that's how you could have a company have an artist's style. One person would draw the keyframes, everybody else would learn to tween them. By the time they'd tweened a few thousand frames, they could draw like the original artist. Right? And so you have company styles of drawing. But we got along computers and we realized we should be able to do the tweening for you. Tell us the key frames, the most important ones, and we will tell you how to get things to move in between them. And one of our techniques for doing that, humans sort of have an understanding of the world. Computers don't. We try to give them an understanding of the world by saying things like skeletons, by giving them some piece of information. Okay? This also helps the artist create the keyframes. Because we can say, just move a few points, we'll figure out all of the rest of the points for you, based on some math we do about the offset of things. So, let's talk first about a little bit about how we do the tweening. So, if artist puts keyframe one, there is a bone here, and keyframe two, that bone is here, how do we decide how it moves? Okay? Well, there's a lot of things that I've left out. For example, maybe those are those points. Okay? So there's more information I need to know. And then I probably also need to know, like, how spun around is it? Like, there's lots of information that you don't initially think matters when you draw a picture that actually does matter. But if we know the starting and ending position, we have another problem, which is we don't know how quickly to move between them. Okay? I don't know what the pattern was supposed to be, but let's assume that the goal was to sort of move the center of the object to the center of the object and to spin it around as it goes. So when it's halfway through, it should sort of be halfway spun. So we should see end A over there. Okay? So we can create this path, and we can pick for any given relationship between it. We can pick the angle and the position. And then we have to decide, does it move uniformly? What is the, how fast does it move? Does it move at a constant speed? Does it move at a different speed? We could also say, oh, you know what? Maybe it moved up. We'll get to how we decide if it's moved up. But the basic idea of if I know to, how do I move between them, gets to this idea that's called easing. Now, the term easing is usually used to talk about things that are very simple animations. This is a page that tries to describe different eases. And if you mouse over something, it will show a little red thing doing the animation. So the horizontal axis is time, the vertical axis here is motion. And different ones will behave differently. Let's get to one that's, you know, somewhat more interesting. Like we can have this one that overshoots and comes back, or overshoots and bounces around and comes back, okay? If I have 2 points, I can describe different ways of moving between them. We have the little wind up before you go. We have the overshoot and figure out what you did. We have the wind up and overshoot, right? We can describe these different kinds of behaviors. How do we ease between frames? It is not intrinsically obvious what the right answer is, because the answer depends on what is going on. Most graphics applications I've interacted with have some sort of default, let's make it a sort of smooth curve over time, but they almost always have a way of a human being able to go in and fix it. Let's think about a reason a human might want to fix it. Let's suppose I were to say, let's say this is the ground. I'm going to say I have a frame here, a frame here, a frame here, another frame right there, another frame right there, and then a frame here, and then a frame here, and then a bunch of frames right there. Okay? This might be the keyframes I provide for 1 foot in a walk. Okay? So I might be thinking, you know, maybe this is somebody's foot, and they're lifting it up, and then they're putting it down, and they're letting it rest on the ground, and then they're picking it up again because they have knees and so on, right? And as they're moving along, I've got these different kinds of visions of how they work, okay? If I have this data, there's a really important piece of data I want to have. I want this behavior to be smooth with no sudden motion. And I want, when you hit the ground, all motion stops, boom. Because that's how physics works. The ground has friction, the air has much less, virtually none. And so if I don't know you had ground in mind, I can't tell which of these keyframes you want to move between smoothly and which ones you want to be firm. And so it is almost impossible to come up with any easing or in-betweening general rule that works in all cases. So we do something, and then we give the animator some way of fixing it. Typically, animators are worse at making smooth than sudden. So we give them smooth, and then if they want to come in and turn it into sudden, we give them that control. Although that varies. I could also say, oh, but grounds happen a lot. I will add special logic for the ground. And then I could say, ooh, but other things happen a lot. We'd have more and more special cases. So if you're going to animate professionally, you want a tool that does all of the common special cases for you. But that gets a more and more complicated tool. When you're an amateur, that becomes confusing. You mean I had to go into this menu and say it's a slippery ground that's wet, right? Why did you have that option? Who would ever want this? Turns out, professional animators want it. Amateur animators don't. And so the level of complication of this will change. Yeah?
Couldn't the tool also like provide the path as like a curve with like control points?
Yep. So like how do I represent this? I could represent it as a curve. The problem is time. Animators almost certainly do not want to see the foot as a swooshy gloob, right? And so what do I draw? So there's all kinds of user interface questions here, right? So actually, in the animation we were seeing in the tweening article, where was that? This is actually a little bit of thing we call onion skinning. So we have the main darker circle in the middle, and then we have some fainter copies of it on either side. This is called onion skinning because in the days of hand animation, there was almost transparent pieces of paper called onion skins, because in the old days, you make them out of onion skins. And you would draw on those and you'd stack them up to get a sense of how it would move over time. Okay? And so we simulate that with computers. And this is a thing that most artists will find reasonably understandable, is this faint ghosted copies of the image at past and future times. But we don't have to do that. I could describe, okay, here is your foot, okay? And I could say, and it is coming from over here and it is going over there. Or I could add, oh, and you know what? We have Bezier handles on this curve. And you can move that around. I could try to give you a space-time graph of the X, Y, and Z coordinates. There's lots of interfaces we could do. And as far as I can tell, we have not gravitated on the one interface that rules them all. Different tools have different ones, and often tools have several. Yes?
Wouldn't you be able to use something like a NURB to kind of weight certain points heavier so like the animation would kind of slow down when you hit that heavier weighted region?
Yes. There's a challenge with NURBs, though. NURBs curves don't touch their endpoints. It is almost never the case that an animator draws a keyframe and is happy if you never reach it. So we don't like NURBs, and there's other kinds of spline-like shapes that do interpolate. And so we will often use those instead. They tend to not be quite as smooth, but the artist will come in and tweak that, and we're not as good at noticing smoothness of motion as we are smoothness of shiny objects. So a lot of what we talked about curves just continues to apply. And we have that ability to handle those. And then a lot of the question here is, how do we give them to the user? Question so far before I dive into why skeletons make this messier. Yeah?
So one thing I've never gotten about skeletal animation is how do you like render the knuckles how do you get the vertices out of the skeletal.
Yeah, so skeletons get messier. All right, if the world consisted only of rigid objects, we would have a fine time. But let's consider, how about your knee? Hey, let's suppose this is my model of your knee bones. We will get to why this is a bad model of your knee bones later. Okay, although it's still a common one. And then I want to have your knee, right? And I want to know, right, oops, there's a little crease here where your calf bumped into it because you've got a little bit of extra flesh there, right, and so on. And I want to know the shape of all of that stuff from just a few points. And so how does that happen? How do I know that this, like, bumps up and it doesn't smooth out, and what do I do? The simple version is, for every point on the surface mesh, I give a relative weight. I find out what its offset should be from each of the bones near it. And then I give some weighting at how much it wants to be between those. This actually works reasonably well. It's a fairly easy thing to compute. I just multiply this point by two matrices and average. Okay? So it's relatively easy to compute. It does tend to make bendy places sort of smear out in ways we don't like. So we can do more complicated things instead. And there have been various approaches of saying, okay, let's imagine there was some physical mass underneath. You have the lump that's at the end of your femur and the lump that's at the beginning of your tibia. And oh, we have a kneecap, and we could try to simulate muscles and so on and do all of this. And occasionally this is done. But this is a lot of work for the artist to specify. It's a lot of work for the computer to simulate. Soft body dynamics is a complicated subject, as we'll probably get to a little later. So doing this right is very hard. It turns out to often work just as well to have every point around a joint as actually the combination of three things. Okay, so we'll take this knee point. We'll say there is the percent that you're related to the femur. There's the percent that you're related to the tibia. And then we will have your offset function as a function of the bendiness of the knee. And then we'll provide some way of the artist essentially what we'll have the artist do is say, model a straight knee, now let's bend the knee. Oh no, it looks bad, fix it for us. We will notice how much they fixed it and we'll use it to infer what this function should be. And this can often work very well, right? If it turns out we have very complicated motion, we can make a few of these. We can use some of our understanding of how bones work and so on to make an initial guess and then let the artist tweak it. There are other techniques that can be used as well, but this is one that works fairly easily. Yes?
So it's like curve fitting based on like specification from the artist.
Yep. And curve fitting is what Beziers do, right? So what does this look like, right? For just 2 points, it's a line, and I say, okay, here is your offset. But if they gave me an intermediate, like a half bent knee and a fully bent knee, then I'd have 3 points and I'd fit the curve between them. Yep. And so then I'd add that offset to whatever the combination of the relative weights of the bones was, and ta-da, I would have everything except self-intersection. Or I could try to model muscle. That is messy. It's hard to overstate how messy that is. Because muscle like has unfortunate things like it remembers where it used to be and it flaps around and it and fast wind and so on, right? Muscle is messy. We don't like, muscle also changes its dynamics based on how tired you are. If you want to do muscles properly, and there are people that spend a lot of effort on that, you have to understand a huge amount about effective finite element methods and how muscles behave and how does lactic acid change the stretchiness of your tendons. And all of this ends up having visual impact. And we may talk some more about that a little later. Questions about this? Yeah?
I have a question on the beam again.
Yeah?
If you have if you're trying to render a scene or like animate a scene where like the objects are like dependent on each other's position and like rotation, isn't that like additional information you have to capture aside from?
Yeah, so that's actually part of the reason why we do bones. Why do we do bones? Is because if we try to interpolate linearly between A and between B, then the object would sort of squish in the middle. So rotation matters. We want rigidity of bits of pieces of things. Bones are a common way of dealing with that. They're not the only way, and you could animate other things. There's actually, when you're thinking about rotation, how do you represent a rotation? How do you represent orientation, I guess is a better phrase. How do you interpolate orientation? So we have represented orientation using normals, but that does not include the spin or matrices, right? A matrix can rotate things around. We've used rotation matrices. How do you interpolate these? It turns out if you interpolate a normal, you'll get a very unpleasant behavior. If I have a normal that goes from here and a normal that goes from here, most of the normals in between, if I just linearly interpolate, have almost the same direction. They'll get this fast zoom through the middle direction as I renormalize them, and slow at the ends, even if that's not the easing I wanted. Okay, so normals don't tend to work very well because the renormalization messes it up. Matrices can work okay, except all the intermediate matrices are not orthogonal. They're not rotation matrices. And it's a fair amount of work to reorthogonalize all of your matrices. Even 3x3, it's not fun to do. So we usually use quaternions. I know what quaternions are mathematically. All right. Quaternions are the 4D extension of complex numbers, obviously. So it turns out, according to the Cayley-Hamilton construction, you can make a complex number-like thing with any power of two number of dimensions, although you lose various properties of operators every time you increase dimensionality. Does this matter? No. But let's think a little bit about why we would care. So complex numbers. If we have a complex number, a plus bi, although in computing, for some reason, it's common to use j instead. Basically because of the C programming language book that used I for all for loops. Anyway, that's a side note. So if we have this complex number where J is the imaginary basis, if we have two complex numbers and we multiply them together, This will have its magnitude will equal the magnitude of C1 times the magnitude of C2. So if we were to take it times its complex conjugate to get the magnitude of the number, we would find that had that behavior. To understand the other half of what's going on here, we need to graph this point. So if I have the real axis and the imaginary axis, okay, and so I have this point here, A, B, and I multiply it by another point, I can think of this as having a magnitude and an angle, polar coordinates. Multiplying complex numbers adds the thetas. Who knew? It works. Hooray! From this, you can get weird things like the Euclid's identity, or Euler's identity, rather, about how we turn complex powers of complex numbers into trigonometry, and anyway, messy. Okay, so if we can make unit length complex numbers, then we have this nice little representation of multiplication does something, and then we can interpolate the complex numbers and get nice smooth behaviors of rotations. So it turns out that interpolating complex numbers is a better way of interpolating planar rotations. If we do quaternions instead, you have three imaginary axes that are different imaginary numbers. The details of this is not super important, but you end up with a four vector where one axis is real and three axes are imaginary. And if you treat the imaginary axis like a normal, that will tell you an orientation. And if you interpolate between them, the interpolations will be very nice and smooth. And so it is common to use quaternions for your actual interpolation. You represent, for drawing it, you want them to be matrices. So you'll have a quaternion under the hood that you'll turn into the matrix, and you'll interpolate the quaternions, and you'll turn them back into matrices. And we could go through all the math there, but I don't want to today. If we decide this is worth going through, we can do that another time. It's not complicated math. It's somewhat counterintuitive math. It involves taking the matrix exponential of imaginary matrices. Anyway, side note. But we can do it. And so this is commonly used to make nice, smooth interpolations. And then, because quaternion interpolation works linearly, and Bezier curves work over combinations of linear, we can then have Bezier curves in the quaternion space to make very nice, smooth rotations. The other thing we think about with rotations is that they are additive for skeletons. Where do I have it? So, if we think about this picture of the hand, if I move this metaphalange, I want all of these phalanges to move as well. You know, I never thought I'd have to learn as many words for bones as I do teaching computer graphics. Anyway, right? Because I want them to all sort of be connected to each other. When one of them rotates, the things attached to it rotate. When you swing your knee, your foot moves. Right? This is an important part of how bodies are constructed. If it didn't happen that way, we would say you were broken. That's not hard to do in your computing. You just need to have this sort of additive model of, okay, this matrix moved the base point and the orientation of that one, and we keep adding them along. And that will give us this notion of things being connected. Questions? Yes?
What if it's like, separate objects? Mm-hmm. Are still like dependent on each other. Like,
what do you mean by dependent? If they're separate, how can they be dependent?
Like a human carrying a basketball.
Yeah, so how do we, so we can make temporary child relationships, okay. Right? And we actually do this. Often graphic programs will have this way of saying, this thing is now stuck to that thing. And that sort of has this temporary child relationship, and then we break it later when it goes away. Yep. Sorry, we use parents and children way too much in computing, in case you hadn't figured out. So we will often call the femur a child of, the tibia child of the femur, because, you know, why not? Yes?
So I meant to ask this a while ago, but when you said like percent femur, percent tibia, I wasn't quite sure how that works.
I mean, I would pick some point and I would say how close is it, like if we pick a point directly in the middle of the knee. It would have where it should be if it was part of the femur alone, where it should be if it was part of the tibia alone, and then just going to average those two. So it's going to be 50% femur's position, 50% tibia's position.
So you extended it up one way and said femur. I might just not know which bone is which, but is it like the left one? Which one did you
thigh, think? Calf, is that better?
Sure.
All right, yes. So I would say, right, thigh, calf. So I would say if you're exactly on the knee, I want to figure out where you would be if you were fully attached to the thigh, where you'd be if you're fully attached to the calf. Average those two positions.
Right. I just felt like you did it backwards when you said it.
Oh, I may have.
Okay.
So for a point that's not like directly in the middle,
it would have more weight of the one it's closer to.
Which of those lines that you're drawing would be for which, like,
right. Okay, let's draw a new one. Okay, let's suppose I want to have this point here. Okay, I would figure out where it would have been if it had come from here. I would figure out where it would have been if it had come from here.
So you just pick an arbitrary place on
the... I would pick that based on where the artist modeled it. So presumably the artist modeled it, maybe the artist modeled it with a straight thing. And so they picked this point. So I would have this offset and that offset as the two that I have base things off of. And then as I rotate this bone around, that bone, right, that offset would move to over here. And now I pick some weighting of those two based on which one I thought it was closer to. Getting a feeling this is still not working. Yes?
I think the thing that confuses me is how you find where it would have been if it was only attached to one bone.
Oh, you have a matrix for the bone? Right? So every bone, what do we know? I know where it's centered, and I know the matrix that describes rotations around it. And so I can apply that center and rotate. I can apply that matrix that represents the bone to any point in the original geometry.
So the lines you're drawing before you average them are based on matrices.
Yes. I'm trying to show the, this is just designed to be a connection. But this, this point is the original model times the thighs matrix. And this point is the original model times the calf's matrix. And this point is the averaging of those two, based on some weighting. Yes?
I think it was confusing because you did that point first.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, we were working backwards.
I apologize for that mistake. Any further questions about this idea? Yes?
How does the artist specify which points are on which bone and which ones are on the knee? Or do they have to?
So usually we provide some sort of heuristic where we say, here's the shape, here's the bones, guess, and then the artist can come in and tweak the numbers, literally. Every tool I have used has some version of this. Other questions? Yeah?
So does this bone also work for non-human or non-existing in our world?
Yes, this works for any sort of, there is a rigid underlying and a squishy thing on top. So this works for all endoskeletal systems. If you want to imagine a non-endoskeletal system, then you can imagine whatever you want to imagine on top of that and create the appropriate animation. It turns out, though, animators get good enough at doing this that we'll often use some version of this even if we decide to do some sort of like squishy, stretchy tentacle. We'll typically give the artist a bunch of bones and let them stretch them out and squish things the other way to maintain volume and smooth it out to make the squishy, stretchy tentacle because they're used to this once we teach them how to do it. All right. Let me just briefly talk about how artists don't want the real world. Okay? Let's imagine that we have a relatively chubby leg here. Okay? And the artist models it like this. Now let's suppose this being needs to kneel, as in an all the way sit on your heels kind of kneel. Okay, so I'm now going to move this bone. This bone's going to come over here, and that one's going to come over there. And what happens to all of this flesh? it disappears. Why is it possible for us to kneel? Squishiness is not the major factor. The major factor is our knee is not one joint. Our knee is two joints, approximately. Okay? So what is actually going on? We have, let's see if I can draw a reasonable facsimile of a bone. Okay, so we have a bone here that has the ball joint behind it. And then we actually have a couple of bones here, but they sort of go down like this, and then there's a special bone floating. Okay? Where does this spin around? Well, this acts like a gear winding around itself. It rolls across itself. The centers of rotation are here and here. There isn't a bone here, but these two roll, and they roll with some fixed reaction because this is a sticky interface. It acts like a gear. It rolls across itself. But it's not a perfectly sticky interface because we actually have these little fluid sacs in between that make things a little bit gooey. And then we have tendons that sort of hold it together, but they aren't attached to the sides of the bones. They're attached to the muscles on the other side, right? It's messy. But approximately what happens when we rotate around is this bone goes around to be here instead. There is no single, right? And so if we were to just pull up our knee and kick our butt, that's where that bone goes. There is no single place to rotate around that will give this result. I have to rotate partly around this and partly around that. But if you tell an artist your knee is two joints, they don't know what you mean. And once you convince them, they say, that's a joint I didn't want to worry about. And if I make it move arbitrarily, bad things happen. Fix it for me. And so there is this whole career. You can be a career rigger. Okay? You can spend your entire life taking models people have made with the important bones they want to think about and creating the real bones under the hood so that everything moves naturally. And it's hard to do because they want these two, the imaginary joint in the middle, to work and everything to stick together, and it isn't possible to do that. So you make these complicated rigs. And rigging is a job. If any animated movie you look at, there will be a list of riggers on the credits, depending on the movie. It's usually a fairly small percentage compared to the number of animators, but there will be multiple people. This is their whole job. Okay? And often they come at this through animation rather than through technology, so although we could write mathematical formulas for knee joints, these are fairly known things. They're not simple things. They involve way more trigonometry than most people that have gotten into this career are used to seeing. And so often we give different interfaces for this, and they're actually rigging tools that are all about how to make good rigs. And they're reusable rigs and customizable rigs and on, okay? So there's this whole space of how to make even something as simple as a knee work in a way that sort of works. And so it gets complicated all in this sort of artist support space. In the end, we end up with a few matrices and a few averages, and we've drawn everything we need to draw. But getting those matrices to average requires the artists, and it's usually multiple artists with different specialties, significant amount of work. Questions about these ideas? All right. Let's just briefly preview the concept of physics-based animation. We're going to use just a few examples. Let's suppose we have a spigot. Okay, and this spigot has a droplet of water. How do we know how the water drops? This is something that is determined by physics. We don't need the artist at all. We just need the artist to say, what shape is the spigot, what kind of material is it, and how fast is the water flowing? And then we can use physics to solve this problem. Now, this is computational fluid dynamics. Computational fluid dynamics is not easy. Really gross oversimplification. We may get into this in significant more detail. We're going to model a subset of the points of water and their interrelationships with each other and the power of surface tension and how things move, and we're going to let it stretch out, and eventually something is going to drop down. And it is not going to look like a water drop, because it turns out just water doesn't do that. It's going to look like a ball. Anyway, but you'll think it looked like a water drop because you only see it when it's moving slowly, and there it does stretch out. Anyway, complicated thing. So, and then maybe you do it with points in the water, and then maybe we're going to say instead, you know what, no. There was going to be this grid, and we wanted to know how much water was in each cell of the grid, and there's two different approaches to water, and we can talk about this at much more length. This is one of approach of purely physics-based rendering. Artist gives us the world, how they want things to work, we do the physics. A partially physics-based rendering might go like this. Artist says, I have my character that's crouched down like this, and then I have my character that's up like this. Okay. Find a way to make this work. And we can then say, what would have needed to happen? So we can say, okay, there was a ground here, and all of the force to get up of here had to be applied to the ground, because humans can't apply force in the air. And this arm needed to move around up there, arms swing. It probably swung in a way that doesn't annoy tendons and had a minimal energy. And so we can solve for the most likely way a person could have done that. So we can solve for the most realistic possible intermediates by using a lot of information about how things work. Right? So we could start by saying, okay, there's a center of gravity, and that needed to move in some way, which means force had to be applied on the center of gravity to give it some sort of motion. There's a gravitational force here, so we can start with that simple, imagine every person is a sphere kind of physics. Okay? And often we will realize, you know what? That force had to come from over there, and their foot wasn't over there. The artist gave us something that's impossible. They don't want us to tell them that. So we're going to pretend they told us something else and minimize how wrong it was. And maybe give them a way of showing them this isn't possible, but we're going to try to make it look as good as we can. Right? And then there's heuristics about how we do that. And then we can also say, okay, of all of the ways of moving between place to place, which one would be most likely not to annoy somebody that was doing it? Because we have all kinds of heuristics about how much arms like to be in different positions, and how much legs like to be bent, and how fast they want to move. We can then compute the kinetic energy and rotational inertia of all of the joints, and how heavy things are. We can start measuring how elastic is the knee joint, and how fast did you crouch, and how much force will it add. And we can spend significant time and energy on this and end up making fancier and fancier smart tweening. Okay? And there are multiple papers published every year of things that I never thought I would see in this space, where people will say, let's just, you know, create a sufficiently sophisticated model of legs that you can say, I want a tired person with an injury in their left leg to walk from here to there. And it will come up with how that person will sort of, like, you know, do whatever it is they do based purely on this math. Okay? And then there are papers that will say things like, we then showed this to random people and asked them which person was happy. And they said, well, that one. And we've learned that if you have bouncy shoes, you look happy. Right? These papers have been published. Okay? So this is a whole space, all kinds of gradations along the way, from the simpleness of bones don't squish, all the way through water splooshes, and everything in between can assist our animation. We have 2 minutes. Questions, comments, concerns? Yes?
To what degree is this done in like game development?
In game development, right now the trend in game development in particular is to have animators with motion capture suits and not worry about the physics at all. They don't even have rigid bones. If the animator's signal happens to say the arm stretched out, we just let it stretch out. We know that was an error in the motion capture, but it's easier to just let it go. Although that may change over time as we get more sophisticated systems. And that isn't what we do if we're trying to, right? If we want to make something that's dramatically non-human or non-horse or non-dog, we need to do something else. But often we'll actually have like an actor act like the back legs of the creature and then act like the front legs of the creature and then average them with math. Yep.
Sounds great.
Other questions? Okay, please go and give your thoughts about what you want to do. I will figure out what we're doing on Thursday sometime before Thursday, I hope. I will see you all on Thursday.